Welcome to the Filmed Live Musicals Podcast, a podcast about stage musicals that have been legally filmed and publicly distributed. The Filmed Live Musicals website contains information on nearly 200 musicals that have been captured live. Check it out at filmedlivemusicals.com. And now, on with the show. Welcome to episode 49 of the Filmed Live Musicals Podcast. I'm your host, Louisa Lyons, and my guest today is actor, singer, and pianist Cynthia Shaw. Her one-woman show, Velvet Determination, all about her quest to study at the Manhattan School of Music, won Best Festival Debut at the New York City United Solo Festival, Best Solo Show at the Pittsburgh Fringe, Best Theater Performance at the Galway Fringe, and Best Personal Story at the Boulder Fringe. It is now available to stream on ScenSaver and YouTube. Welcome, Cynthia.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I'm really happy to be here.
I'm so delighted to be chatting with you today. So to start us off, what made you fall in love with musical theater?
Musical theater. Oh my goodness. Well, it's about music and it's about storytelling. I mean, I come from obviously a musical background since I played the piano. And so even when I was taking piano lessons as a kid, and I talk about this a little bit in my show, is that I would play the pieces, but there would always be pictures and stories with all of the tunes, all of the melodies. And so I would make up stories as I was playing the pieces. So I always had this idea of music and storytelling going together at the same time. And then, of course, I started singing in choirs, and in choirs, there's music and stories. And then when I got into high school, then I was in a couple of musicals. And in fact, I was Golda in Fiddler on the Roof, which was awfully fun. So yeah, I've always just loved musicals. I love people make fun of musicals. Oh, the tap dancers, like they just start tapping in the middle of nowhere or something like that, you know, but I think that's really wonderful. I love the fantasy of musicals. I love people expressing themselves on stage singing. So I love music.
Growing up in Pueblo in Colorado, what access did you have to live theater?
Well, there was a I can't think of the downtown theater. My dad was a musician, and so he would play the symphony. So he would play, and we would go there. But there would also be touring companies coming through town, putting on musicals, putting on theater, and we didn't go a lot, but like we would go to high school productions, and I'm trying to think. And then an art center was built, and then they started doing larger, mostly in-town productions. So yeah, so we would just go see whatever we could.
And you talk a little bit in the show about always wanting to play piano and that it was something that just you had to do. Can you talk to us a little bit more about that?
Yeah. That's an interesting question, actually. And I don't. Like when you perform and you create, you don't know why it is you have this thing inside of you that you makes you want to do it. Like you don't know, I don't know why I wanted to practice. I don't know why I wanted to play the piano. I know that, you know, once I started piano lessons when I was in kindergarten, actually, I never stopped having piano lessons. And even if I didn't want to practice, because that's a whole other issue, right? Even if I didn't want to practice, what I did like was to play the pieces. I liked playing the pieces. And then my sister played the flute. And so then she and I would play flute and piano duets together. And in fact, at one point, I actually knew all of the flute repertoire because she was a very advanced player. So I knew all of the flute repertoire. So I knew all of the flute repertoire. So I don't know. I mean, maybe playing the piano made me special. Like I think about this sometimes. Like it made me special amongst my peers. It was like this special gift that I have that other people didn't have. So maybe it set me apart a little bit, and that sounds a little egotistical, actually. But, but yeah, it did. You know, I remember like you're very young. But I remember when the Beatles came on the scene, right? That was a big thing, and we got all the Beatles recordings, you know. And then I wanted to have like all the Beatles music, and I would play through the Beatles music, or I would play through musical theater books, or I just loved being able to sit down and play.
Did it ever enter your mind to be an accompanist, a musical theater accompanist, or to play in the pit?
I kind of came to that gradually because of playing with my sister. So I was always accompanying her on flute. And then when I was in high school, I accompanied, even though I sang in choir, I also accompanied the choir. And so when I went to college, so I got to be a really good accompanist, actually, following people. And I was always a really good music reader. And I was also a really good sight reader, probably because I just spent a lot of time just reading through music. So by the time I got to college, I actually was on an accompanying grant. And I played for voice lessons. I played for choir. I never played for musicals. I was never involved in the theater department in college or a graduate school, but I did a lot of accompanying. So when I was, there's all this stuff, you know, anyway, I started singing a lot. I know there's just so much stuff. I started singing a lot and got a job at a children's theater camp in the Catskills one summer. Mm. And I started musical directing there. And I discovered that I liked it and it was fun. And I was actually pretty good at it. You know, I could hear really well. I could hear when people were singing in tune, out of tune. I could help. I could help people with their parts, fitting everything together. And the other part of it was that I enjoyed so much being with other people. And so that's how musical directing came about for me.
Mm. Oh, I love that. And when you were talking about not wanting to practice, the playing through music was itself a kind of practice. Like you said, like it developed your sight reading skills and that was, yeah. So it was a kind of practice in a way, even if it wasn't scales.
Exactly. In fact, scales were my big bugaboo. Yeah. So no, in fact, I have a really funny story, actually. I'll tell you my little story. So when I was studying with my teacher, I think I was in grade school, I went to my lesson and I hadn't practiced the music at all. I played through it, but I hadn't practiced. And my teacher said to me, "Oh, Cynthia, you sound so good this week. You know, whatever you're doing now, you should keep it up. That's really, you've really excellent." I was like, "Oh my God, this is fantastic. I don't have to practice. This is great. I never have to practice again." So that next week I didn't practice at all. And I go back to my lesson. And he's like, "Oh, Cynthia, what happened? You were so great last week and this week, not so good." I was like, "Ugh." So I guess I do have to practice.
I've had a similar experience where a teacher, I didn't practice and I just like magically got through the lesson on flute, actually. And my teacher was like, "Oh, you've been practicing so hard." And I was like, "Oh, I got away with it." She was exactly. A stickler for practice.
Exactly. Although now what I understand is that a lot goes on in our heads when we're not practicing. Like there's still all this work going on that is like unconscious work. So I think sometimes too, we can practice too much, right? And we like over practice and then we kind of kill it. So sometimes stepping back gives you a little more leeway. So, yeah.
Absolutely. So you mentioned that your dad was a musician and mm-hmm. You talk about in the show your grandmother being a pianist for silent movies.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Well, I don't know too much about that because it was she got married later. And so, but mm-hmm. What I do know, she was from a small town in Oklahoma called O'Keene. And she was a school teacher. And then on the sides, she would play silent, you know, piano for silent movies. So, I mean, I always knew of her as a pianist and I knew that she played, although she had a very, she and my grandfather, I don't know, it wasn't a very happy marriage. So, like maybe she played, but it was not a big part of my understanding of her. But I did know that she played silent piano for movies. So I thought that was pretty nifty.
It is so cool. Something that, I mean, I know that there are silent movie screenings now and that people it's kind of like making a comeback in a way,
yeah.
But it's, to have live music with movies again.
Well, and also what's really great about silent movie pianists is that musically they pick up the, what's happening in the story. You know, they pick up the train scene, you know, or the love scene, all of that stuff. And so it really enhances what's happening, you know, or if like, like in New York, there's oftentimes I want to say ghost or vampire or old movies, you know, and they'll play that spooky music. And I think it really enhances it.
Yeah, it's so much fun. Did you, growing up in Pueblo or even when you moved to New York, were you ever watching theater on screen? Like on PBS or things like that?
Not really, I don't think. But the thing is, those things didn't really exist for the most part. They didn't really exist then. Maybe, I mean, I must have seen, when I came to New York, I must have watched some things on PBS, but I don't remember specifically anything. So no, it was usually everything was live. Yeah. Or recordings. Yeah.
Okay. So let's fast forward to New York and Velvet Determination. What led you to create this beautiful one-person show?
I was thinking about my time when I came to New York and all of the things that happened to me along the way. And I had all these little stories of things that had happened. And I started thinking, wow, you know, this might make sort of a fun show. It might make, like young people might be interested in this sort of as a kind of inspirational thing that when you come to a new place and you're young and you have all these adventures but as you're having these adventures and things are happening to you, bad things, right? And good things, but bad things especially, right? That you overcome them and you move forward, right? So I sort of was thinking about it in that way. I didn't really know that much about solo shows, but I started seeing a couple of friends were doing solo shows. I was like, oh, that's an interesting platform. And initially I thought that the show would be a cabaret. That was my original thought. But then I couldn't find any New York songs that I really liked to be part of this cabaret. So then meanwhile, I started seeing people doing solo shows. And then I thought, oh, well, maybe that could be possible. But you also have to understand, I'd never written anything before. That's the other big part of this. I'd never written anything before. And so I went to a show at 59 East 59th Street by this Canadian pianist named Hershey Felder. And he did a show. It was the first one of his that I saw. I've seen a whole bunch of them now, but his first one that I saw, he played Leonard Bernstein. And so he followed Leonard Bernstein's life from birth to death. It was like amazing. And he played the piano and he acted and he told Leonard Bernstein's story. And I thought, after I saw that show, I thought, oh my God, there is a place for a solo show about classical piano. And so not that I'm Leonard Bernstein and not that I'm Hershey Felder, you know, but I thought, but I have my story. And so that was when I started writing my stories down and, you know, just sort of getting them out of my system. And I had like 20 pages of just random writing. And then I took a solo writing class with Austin Pendleton, who's a very famous actor here in New York. And at our first class, there were like six or seven of us. We all told what our story was. And he said, all right, well, next week we're going to start performing our shows. And I was like, oh my gosh, I don't have a show. I don't have anything other than this rambling, you know. But it was good because it forced me I had a week to even start. And that was how the whole process started.
Wow, that's nothing like a deadline to make it happen,
nothing
right?
Nothing like a deadline. Nothing like a deadline. I know. And it was exactly what I needed because I could have been rambling on for a long time, just writing and writing and writing. And then after I took that class, I still didn't have a show, but I had something closer. And then I started working with my first director, Paige Clemens, and she and I would get together every 2 weeks and we would just go through what I had written and we would talk about it and we would organize it. And that went on for a year of us meeting every 2 weeks. Yeah. And then finally, in the beginning, at the end of 2018, then that was when I performed that show at the United Solo Festival. So that iteration of my show. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Just quickly, I want to go back to Hershey Felder. I love that he inspired all of this because over the pandemic, he was so prolific in releasing these beautiful events that, you know, were filmed on location and
were
absolutely astonishing.
They were totally astonishing. I mean, my gosh, I saw the Beethoven one. I saw Rachmaninoff. I saw Tchaikovsky. Strauss, I think I saw. Just wonderful. And you're right. As things moved on, because he was in Italy at that point, I think he probably still is in Italy, right? They got more and more sophisticated and more complicated and bringing in people. And Shalom Aleichem, he did him. So totally inspirational.
I really love that tie-in. Remind me the name of your first director?
Paige Clements.
Paige Clements. So you'd been working with Paige and then you performed it at the United Solo Festival. What was that like as not having written a show before and then going into a solo festival for the first time?
I know. It was actually really great because Paige and I, once we got the show to a place that we thought it was in performance, we got together, I don't even know for how many months, every week. And we worked on the show, ran the show. So by the time I actually did the show, I felt very comfortable in it. I just felt very, very comfortable in it. So it was not stressful like it could have been if I hadn't felt comfortable in it. So I felt very ready.
Ready.
Yeah.
Were the pieces that you had selected for the show things that were already in your wheelhouse, or were you learning new material for the show?
You were asking the best questions. I love your questions.
Oh, thank you.
So the music for the show, this is a really interesting question. You are the first person that has actually asked this question. So the music for the show, no, you are. The music for the show initially, I wanted to have music in my show that had actually been in my life. Like I wanted to play in my show the piece that I played for my audition, or I wanted to have in my show pieces that I played for my John Thompson books, right? I wanted to have the real pieces. So a lot of the music was that music. But a lot of the music, I honestly couldn't remember what I had played. Like, I have no idea what I played for my second Manhattan School audition. I really don't know. So it was kind of a combination. And then there were a couple of other things that went into it. I end the show with the Debussy L'Île Joyeuse, which I had been working on for like, I don't know, 3 years. And so I knew that I wanted to, I know, right? But you know how music is. You work on for a long time. So I knew that I wanted to end the show with that piece. And then I always loved the Bach Italian Concerto. And so I knew that I wanted to start the show with that. And again, the Bach Italian Concerto, I've been playing for, I mean, like 30 years, 40, like a long, long time. So
it is in your bones now.
It is my bones. Yeah. So I knew that I wanted to start the show with that. And then in the middle of the show, I play the Chopin Nocturne in C sharp minor. And I always loved that piece. But the thing about that particular piece is that when I was auditioning for undergraduate school, I believe, I have this very, very distinct memory of playing that piece for an audition. And so every time I play it, I just remember that time. So yes, so that piece is... So it's kind of a combination of pieces that I played for a long time and pieces that I decided to do in the show.
Mm-hmm. And again, I can't remember if I said this in the recording. I know I said it before the recording, but the choices of music are so beautiful. I would love you to release a cast recording if you would.
I did.
Oh, there is a cast recording.
Yes.
Oh my gosh. Okay, I'm going to go buy it.
All right. It's actually on Bandcamp. Mm-hmm. So if you just look up Cynthia Shaw or Bandcamp, you can buy it. So it's amazing. It's the greatest. It's not the great, but it's the music from Velvet Determination. The greatest is.
Oh, yay. That is going into my rotation of music that I play all the
time.
Oh,
excellent. Excellent. So I don't have everything, but I have, I have the recording up here, but I have like eight pieces that I play in the show. So. Mm-hmm.
Oh, wonderful. Yay. It's a sampler platter.
Exactly.
Sampler platter.
Exactly. Oh, good.
And so your very first show, you win Best Festival Debut at the Solo Festival. And then what comes next?
So let's see. After I did that, so that was 2018. That was October 2018. And then I did the show. Like we were visiting friends in New Hampshire for Thanksgiving, and I did the show there. And then I went home to Pueblo, and my mom was like, oh, you have to do the show here. And so I performed the show at my church, actually, so where I grew up. And so that was in the sanctuary. So that was really cool. And there were all these people that came. So that was really great. And then...
I have to pause you there. Yeah. Wow. I like knowing what you share in the show, how was that to... What was that like talking to the people that were kind of in that world?
Well, I have to tell you that the show that you see, that you saw, is not the show that I performed. Okay. Because there comes a point at which I totally rewrote the show. And that's what you see. The show that I do now, if I did that show in my hometown... In fact, it sort of brings up a little dilemma, because my mom wants me to do the show again in December for all of her female friends. And there's some things I have to take out of the show because, I just have to take them out. So, yes.
Yeah.
No. No. And in fact, I was supposed to perform the show in January of 2020. Or 2021, I can't remember, in my hometown in the big hall. And I was having a major dilemma with that because of that very thing that I didn't know how, I didn't know how to deal with all of that. So anyway, what happened with the show is that, so I performed it the next year in 2019, I performed it in Colorado Springs. At the Millibo Theater, which was a great experience. It's a wonderful theater in Colorado Springs. And then that summer, I did it in Galway. I did it in Capitol Fringe in Washington, D.C. And I performed it at the Pittsburgh Fringe and Boulder Fringe. So I had a whole big run. So by the time I finished with Boulder Fringe, I had performed the show a whole bunch. And I felt like there were things that no longer worked for me in the show. And I wasn't sure what to do. And so I spoke with Paige, and she and I talked about it. And we both realized that the two of us had gone as far as we could together. And so we had a mutual breakup. And, and it was, that's the hardest thing to do but she felt the same way. She goes, I just feel like I've taken your show as far as I can, and I don't think I can take it in any further than that. And I was feeling the same thing. So we broke up, and then I had met Peter a few months before, and I just thought he was brilliant, just totally brilliant. And so
this
was
Peter Michael Marino.
Peter Michael Marino. And he was one of those people that, like, you start to talk about something and he gets it immediately. Like, he knows exactly what you're saying, and he already has some solutions, some ideas, some thoughts, some whatevers, right? And so I sent him my show, And I had actually started to rewrite my show anyway with somebody else, right? So I send him that version, which was either a mistake or not a mistake, but it didn't really matter. Because he said to me, he read my show, he loved my show, but he's like, you have to rewrite this show. And so he and I would get together. And I mean, he had some general notes. So I started rewriting again. And then we got together a couple of times and I would start reading through sections. And he would say things like, well, but what about this? Or, well, what about this? Or his big note to me was, you know, your father is like the big thing in your show. And you have him at the beginning of your show and we never hear about him again. We need to hear about your father all the way through the show. I was like, oh, okay. So, yeah. So then he and I started working together on the show. And it keeps changing and keeps growing. And I keep finding new things. I'm like, oh, I want to put this in or whatever. So it's been a real work in progress, I would say.
And in like right before the shutdown in 2020, you performed at the Winterfest at the New York Theater Festival.
Yes, yes.
What was the decision, or had you filmed previous incarnations of the show and made them available, or was this the first time?
I had my first show at United Solo videotape, but it wasn't a very good the quality was not good at all. So I have it, but it's not really useful. But for that show, I decided to hire somebody who could do a really good job. So, and he did, I think he did a really good job. He did a long shot, he did close-ups. And the beauty of that performance, I did three performances. The beauty of that performance was the night that we decided to videotape, I had the best audience. They laughed. They were like the best audience. I was like, oh my gosh, I could not, because sometimes you perform and like there's dead silence all the time, right? so that was really, really good. So yeah, that was the first really good videotape I could have at the show.
Oh, I love that. When you filmed it, did you always have the intention to stream it?
No. No.
What led you to decide to put it up online?
I don't know. Ego. I don't know.
It's what actors do now.
It's what we actors do now. Yeah. I mean, I think I put it up there, just to have it up someplace. And then when it got picked up by, Scene Saver. Yeah. That was actually through, the Kyiv people, through the pro English, festival. They're the ones that said that you know, in order to be in their festival, I had to put it up on that platform. So that's how it got up on that platform. I did not put it there just for me. I just put mine on YouTube.
Got it. And that ProFest, it's super cool. I've started dabbling in some of the content from that is available on SceneSaver, and it's they live streamed during 2020, like. No, it was more recent than that. It was like during the Russian invasion, and there were like, it was like in an underground bunker kind of thing. Oh, it was very intense. Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
Really amazing stuff.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
I'm very curious about, you've traveled the show all over, and this year you've done a kind of like international tour going like New York, Rochester, Kiev, Reykjavik, and Edinburgh. What is it like to be doing the festival circuit?
It was really fun. I mean, it was really, really fun. I mean, it was great to be able to go to these places. I didn't really necessarily mean for it to happen in that way, but it did. We had been to Iceland before in 2015. And so when, you know, when things started opening up, you know, and people are starting to do things, and, you know, I was supposed to go to Edinburgh in 2020, but of course that didn't happen. And then 2021, maybe, but my space was not open and everything was up in the air anyway. So I just decided that 2022, I was going to go. And, you know, even though people were like, well, I don't know if things are going to be open and what happens if this and what, and I was like, no, I'm going. It's time. So anyway, so that was set. And then because of that, I was supposed to, in 2020, perform at the 59 East 59th Street East to Edinburgh Festival, and that didn't happen. So then I was able to, this time around, in preparation for Edinburgh. So those two things went together. And then there was the idea of the Nordic Fringe Festivals, and I've always loved Scandinavian countries. I've always loved all of that. And so I decided to submit to those countries, and I submitted to Iceland, and then I submitted also, I think, to Sweden. I think those were the two. But I just decided to go to Iceland. That was the only one I did. Plus, I mean, the thing is, it's really expensive. Yeah. All of this is really expensive. And so I thought, no, I'll just do one. So we did Iceland. And then, so that's kind of how it came about. And then Rochester Fringe Festival in September, my friend Mary Goggin, who has a show, she had performed at Rochester Fringe, and she said, oh, why don't you see if you can perform at my venue? Because Rochester is like Edinburgh. You have to apply to the venues in order to be chosen. And so I applied to her venue, and they accepted my show. And so then that's how Rochester happened.
And when you're traveling to all of these places, do you bring your own keyboard, or are you requesting one when you get there?
I always request a piano, always. and I get all sorts of different kinds of pianos. So in Reykjavik, they had a beautiful grand piano, this Favioli grand piano on a stage. Fantastic. So that was really neat. At 59 East 59th Street, I had to bring my own electric piano. I have a Yamaha 125. In Edinburgh, I rented a piano, an electric keyboard. Again, a Yamaha 125. And then in Rochester, they had a upright piano that I used. But the fun thing is that I was thinking, you know, it's too bad there's not like a folding piano that I could take with me that I could practice on, because you can't practice when you go to these places. You can't go to the hall because there's all these other shows going on, right? And I thought, and so I looked up online, folding piano. Well, as it turns out, there is a folding piano. You can buy a, I couldn't believe it. And so then later there's like a whole bunch of them. So I started doing all this research, and I found this guy on YouTube that compared three different folding pianos. And he was a serious, like, I'm a classical pianist, so I don't need like a little junky piano. I need a piano with weighted keys, full-size keys, and 88 keys. I don't care about the sound. I care about what it feels like. Anyway, so he compared three different folding pianos. And his recommendation was this one that I hadn't even heard of in my research. And that was the one I bought. So for $188, I bought this Magicon white folding piano. I took it to Reykjavik first, and then I took it to Edinburgh. Yeah, I could carry it on the plane. Wow. If it folds to about, I don't know, 18 inches, maybe, maybe less than 18 inches.
Wow. So it could like fit in carry-on luggage.
Exactly.
Amazing. Exactly.
It's totally amazing. And I think it's so awesome that I made like some videos about it, and all these people are like, a folding piano? I've never heard of that. So I send them my little video that I made of the folding piano, because it's just so great. Even, I mean, my publicist in Edinburgh, her name is Valerie Potter. She was amazing. So she's worked with the rock and roll pianist Rick Wakeman forever. And when I was a kid, I was like Rick Wakeman, because he was a classical pianist that played rock and roll. And so even he said, I've never heard of that. So I sent Valerie my video. I was like, here, send this to Rick so he can see it. So yeah. So, but you just get all kinds of pianos.
Yeah, I'm sure, like, I'm envisioning horror stories of, like, what kind of instrument they put before you, and, like, what conditions it's in, and the tuning, and pedals, all of that.
Yeah, I mean, the hard thing actually was in Rochester, because I performed in a bar, and it was in the back of the bar, but the bar was noisy in the front, and so whenever anybody is at the piano, they're always on a mic. Now, I don't have a wireless mic. Everything is always acoustic. And even when I was in Reykjavik, the sound guy, who was wonderful, put a mic on the stage for me at the base of the piano. So that was really great. But in Rochester, they had a handheld mic. And so in my show, as you know, I go back and forth between playing the piano, talking at the piano, standing up, talking, back and forth, back and forth. And I had to quickly figure out how to choreograph the mic on the mic stand, then getting the mic out of the mic stand, going and talking to people, going back to the so that was quite a learning curve in like an hour. I had to figure that one out. Yeah, so that was tricky, but I got it working. It worked out just fine.
And now I'm envisioning for like version 3.0 of this show that it starts with a suitcase and you open up to reveal the folding piano and then a piano magically appears in the Broadway version.
I love
this. It will fly in a piano.
I love this because my folding piano is so awesome. It really is. So yeah, it's white too. Like they don't even have a black folding piano. They have a white folding piano. It's like so weird.
Does it have black key? Like, does it have the black keys?
Yeah, black and white keys. Okay. Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah, a Magicon. You can look it up on Amazon. $180.
It sounds very cheap for something that is like, it's magical.
It is. It's totally magical. Yeah. No. Wow. I love that idea. I love that idea. I might steal that idea from the next iteration of my show.
Freely. what is it like traveling post-COVID?
I don't have a problem with it. I was fine. And I was, shockingly enough, my husband and I, we were both like, we flew on the planes without any masks. We were unmasked the whole time in Reykjavik. We were unmasked the whole time in Scotland. I had no trouble with that at all.
Oh, so lucky.
Yeah. I mean, by the time we got to, I know that, Edinburgh, you know, had been pretty severely locked down, but then when the UK opened up, they just opened up. They just said, that's it. You know, people are going to get COVID. Oh, well, but do you know what I mean? That's kind of how I felt. And so I found it really freeing, totally freeing, because here in New York, you know, I mean, even now you going to some theaters, you have to mask the whole time. And but I didn't have any trouble traveling post-COVID at all.
Oh, that's very lucky.
Yeah.
Do you have any fun road stories?
Oh, dear. I don't know. I don't know.
Here's a different question.
All right.
What has the audience's reactions been?
So it's interesting. I mean, first off, you either have an audience that's dead silent throughout the whole show, or I have an audience that laughs uproariously. I've had audiences that cry at the end, because of, you know, when I talk about my dad, you know, and all of that, so it kind of runs the gamut in that way. Wait, ask your question again, because now I forgot, because I got carried away with my own answer. The audience's response.
How do audiences react?
Yeah. So, when I first did the show, I was shocked that people responded and said things to me that I did not expect at all. That people said my show made them think about their own personal artistic journeys, made them think about their own personal epiphany moments, made them think about their teachers and their lives, all of this stuff. That was never my intention at all, right? And so that really surprised me a lot. So now I sort of understand that people will have this response. I've gotten the response that people are so happy that I'm willing to be honest about how I feel about certain things in the show, and that I'm sort of straightforward about it because it allows them to look at choices that they've made. You know, it's all about choices, right? And things, and we all have things that happen to us, and that the idea of overcoming those obstacles or whatever in a positive, joyous way, like help them, right? I had one boy in Edinburgh, I'll never forget this, like 13-year-old kid. And he said, he came up, he was a little shy, little kid, little boy. And he says, I play the piano too. And I said, oh, that's really great. And he said, your show helped me a lot.
Oh.
And I was like, oh my God. Like speaking the truth or speaking about obstacles and overcoming them, and like my show helped him a lot, and that was like the best thing anybody could say to me about the show. Because, you know, and one thing that Peter said to me while we were working on the show is he says, you cannot get self-indulgent, you have to just tell your story. Because if you get self-indulgent, then it's about you. You have to tell your story and let people, the audience, feel what they're going to feel, right? You don't want to manipulate them, you know? And it kind of reminded me, I had seen this show on Broadway, off Broadway a few years ago. And this woman, her father had been a famous baseball announcer. And so she had a mixed relationship with her father. And at the end of the show, she got all weepy and all cheery about her father and blah, 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 blah. And I was just like, is this therapy? Right. That's how I felt all of a sudden, you know, and Peter's like, and he said that to me, it was so interesting. He's like, no, you cannot make the show therapy about yourself. You have to tell your story and let people take from it what they're going to take from it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, but that little boy, oh, that was the best.
How powerful. I would love to know his story, what inspired him and what helped him. And
yeah. But he was so shy. And I wish I had said, what helped you? What was it? But there were like a bunch of people around and it was just really hard to, and he was so shy. He was just so shy. Mm-hmm. So I thought, well, I'm gonna take it for that.
Yeah, that's really beautiful.
Yeah.
If you could go back to your younger self, who was, you know, desperate to be in New York and desperate to be at the Manhattan School of Music, what would you say to her now?
I would say that what you have to give is important. And the things that you create are worth being created and are worth being seen. I mean, okay. I have on my wall, I have one of those chalkboard on my door. I painted my door. So it's like a chalkboard. And at the bottom, now this is like really corny. I know, I'm sorry. But I wrote at the bottom, it says here, my work matters. I am seen. And I think that I would tell my younger self that I would have, I mean, I still struggle with this, right? But I would have sparks of this feeling that what I created and what I do is important. And then it would be shut down by all of these things like, you're not doing it right. Oh, you need to do this. You need to do that. You're not good enough. I mean, I always suffered from, you're not good enough and no one wants to listen to you. You're not good enough. You're not good enough. And the question always becomes, well, when are you good enough? Right? And I think when I came to New York and I really thought that the only people who could come to New York who were allowed to get off the airplane were people that were excellent. No, this is what I really thought. They were excellent. You had to be excellent in order to be allowed to be in New York. And then when I got here and I realized that that was not the case, right, at all, like anybody could get off the plane in New York, right? But I had this false sense of what was acceptable or what was good enough or whatever. And I was constantly, I had horrible nerves. I had horrible stage fright. I had, I can't even tell you, I had horrible, horrible stage fright. And I, gosh, you're just reminding me of all of these things. I used to accompany this group called the New Jersey Cantors Ensemble. I've done a lot of Jewish music. I play for a lot of Jewish music. And so I play for this group, the New Jersey Cantors Ensemble. And they were a group of cantors from like old time cantors to like contemporary cantors. And it was a choir. And so I would accompany the choral numbers that they would do together. But they were such a disparate group, like, and then I would play for when they do their solos. We do these big concerts. And I think for me, that was the biggest learning experience because what I learned was, first off, they were never prepared. They were never prepared for the concerts because they always had their temples. They had all their temple music to music for Friday, everything, right? They were never prepared. And no matter what, they would get up on stage and they would put on the best show. And they would make so many mistakes. So many. I'm there playing for them, watching all this stuff happening, you know? And yet, man, the show went on. And for me, who like lived in the world of perfection, that was a huge learning experience. And it really freed me up a lot and helped me get over my nerves.
That is such a difficult thing with classical music, and that I hear, especially from opera singers, how rigid that world can be and how debilitating that can be for some
people. Totally. You play a wrong note, it's like your life is over.
Yeah.
I mean, it's so severe and so, so strict. So it makes it really hard because then you're constantly judging yourself. It's like, and then it makes you nervous. And of course you make more mistakes, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm curious how that has impacted your teaching work.
Oh, yeah. It's interesting. I try to balance it with my students. It's funny, actually. I was just, right before I am talking to you, I was just teaching. And we're working on this Bach Jig. No, it's a Gavotte. And I said, you know, we have to make it dance. It has to dance. It doesn't matter about the notes. We have to let it dance, you know? So like trying to balance those things, you do have to play the right notes. You have to play the right notes, right? But you also can't let the right notes and technique be the only thing. You can't let that be the performance, right? So you're always balancing those two things. Of making the beautiful music, but at the same time, making sure that you play the right notes. So it is a funny thing, and in a sense, I'm kind of jealous of jazz people because you know they can play wrong notes and it's a-okay, hunky dory. You know,
that's jazz, baby.
Yeah, yeah. But also for me in my show, because I do play classical music and I still have to practice my pieces, but in the show itself, like I would have performances where I would like make a mistake or make a boo-boo or make a whatever. And I'm just like, let it go. Nobody cares except for you. You're the only one who cares. Nobody is there to hear you play your music correctly. They're not.
No.
Yeah, that's right. It's really
what a
hard.
Powerful lesson that is.
It really is. And I think, yeah, I mean, I'm not in music school now, so I don't know what it's like now. But for me, you know, it started to become all about that. And then you just have all these, you know, as I talk, say in my show, all these demons yapping in your head, telling you how horrible you are. Mm. You know, we have enough
what
of that.
What do you think? I was going to ask this question as like that opera and classical music stream a lot, that they're filmed and they're available a lot. And so what could musical theater learn from classical music? But I want to rephrase it. What do you think classical music and musical theater can learn from each other?
Well, it's interesting, first off, because you oftentimes now see a lot of crossover, right? You see musical theater performers performing opera. I think that opera could learn from musical theater is that we want to know what the words are. We want to understand what in the Sam Hill you're saying, you know, so that we don't need subtitles there to tell us what you're singing about. So I think that opera could certainly learn from musical theater in that way. I think that musical theater could learn from opera the beauty of the voice and the beauty of singing, because sometimes you have people, but I don't know. Even as I say these words, I don't know, because there's so many wonderful musical theater performers that aren't good singers at all, and nobody cares, right? You don't care because they're such great actors, and they allow the music to just shine in and of itself, right? So, yeah, I mean, I think I wish musical theater didn't have so much belting going on. I think sometimes there's a lot of not very pretty singing, you know, from people that are legitimately singing, but belting, because honestly, it's not very healthy for the voice. I mean, I remember reading or somewhere that Rent, when it was on, that so many young people blew their voices singing Rent. And I think that that's a horrible, horrible shame, pity that people shouldn't have to go through, you know, singing with so much tension and so singing so improperly. So I think if opera could give musical theater anything, it would be singing well, so that people could have long careers and didn't have to blow their voices.
Singing safely.
Yeah, singing safely, exactly. Because opera people, they know how to do that. But also opera people don't have to do 8 shows a week. Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
We don't have to. But on the other hand, opera people don't get mics like musical theater people do. Right? So, you know, an opera person has to fill a house. They have to fill the Metropolitan Opera of 3,500 seats, how much ever it is. Mm-hmm. I don't know how they do that.
And then it leads in my head to the next, I won't ask this, but, you know, what is the difference between opera and musical theater? It's such a fun question. And I love Sondheim's answer. It depends what house it's in.
Yeah. I mean, I wish that opera could find its voice amongst younger people, and that people could understand, could connect to it deeper. You know, when I was a kid, like when you watch cartoons, all of the music in cartoons was from the operas, all of it.
Bugs Bunny and
Bugs Bunny, all Looney of those. Tunes. So that when you went to an opera, when people went to operas, they already knew all the music already. You know, and I think that idea of opera being in popular culture has been lost. I mean, classical music has lost that actually too, but being more in popular culture. And I think it's sad that the two have like split off, you know, in a horrible way. So, you know, I mean, like I think that the Live at the Met at the movie theaters is a fantastic thing, in the same way that the National Theater Live is fantastic. You know, I think that Live at the Met is great for two reasons. One, it allows people who don't have the opportunity to actually go to New York, to go to the Met, to see operas. That's the first thing. But the second thing is that I think it supports local opera companies because people were like, oh, that's what opera is. Well, that's kind of cool. Well, maybe I'll go support my local opera. So I think it's a win-win.
Yeah, I could not agree more. So speaking of, what is next for Velvet Determination?
Okay, so that's a really good question. So I don't have any performances. I've sort of done my performances. So there's a, sort of a two-prong thing going on with Velvet Determination. One is that I need to find more places to perform. So, you know, it's on my list of things to find places and also places that can pay me because, as I said, you know, doing these fringe festivals is fantastic, but it's expensive. You know, you pay for everything. So, so that would be the first thing. But then the second thing, which is a bigger picture idea, is that I have been approached by many people that this particular story would make a really good TV series.
Ooh.
Yeah. So, so that's kind of on my radar. So working with some people that I work with to try and sort of develop it, to take the seed of the story and develop it into something bigger. I mean, you know, like I think about like Mozart in the Jungle, about classical music, or I don't think there's enough in popular culture about classical music, you know, or, you know, you have like Whiplash, which is not exactly the most positive.
Yeah.
Look at classical music, you know? So anyway, those are two things that are in the works.
Ooh, that's very exciting. And I love that it's like bringing it back to the screen as well, because how better to disseminate it to people than on screen.
Exactly.
So we've come to my final segment. It's called My Favorite Things, where I ask you my favorite questions about film live musicals.
These are a few of my favorite things.
So first up, what is your favorite musical?
My favorite musical? Oh my gosh. Wow, wow, wow. Well, I mean, I have to say, okay, so I loved Something Rotten. Did you see Something Rotten?
I did. I know the music, though. Oh, my God. And it played at the St. James, which is my home theater.
Yes, yes. I love that musical so, so much. So I love that musical. I love Hadestown. I've seen Hadestown a couple of times, and I just think it is, like, the best. So let me just think in recent past, other than those two musicals, what I loved. Oh, I loved the Monty Python musical.
Spamalot?
Yes, I loved Spamalot. Oh my God. I don't know. I think I like these musicals that are quirky and funny and Yeah,
tongue in cheek.
Yeah, tongue in cheek. I like that stuff. Oh, the other one that I love. Oh my gosh. Floyd Collins. Have you ever seen Floyd Collins?
Yes. Yes.
Floyd Collins, the music, the everything of that show. Everybody, listeners, listen to Floyd Collins. I think it's a brilliant show.
Really, yeah. So powerful and devastating at the same time.
Yeah. And actually, what's for me personally interesting about that show is that for 2 months I was working at a theater in Kentucky where it takes place. And I was living right across the street from the, I forget the name of the museum, but it's a caving museum. And it's actually where Floyd Collins's remains were for a while.
Whoa.
Yeah. And so where the area that I was is where the whole Floyd Collins story took place. Because there's Mammoth Cave, which is like 400 miles of cave. So like in New York, I don't really think about caves very much. But in Kentucky, in Western Kentucky, Eastern Kentucky, caves are huge. So that made the story that much more interesting to me. Yeah.
Wow. Ooh, it makes it more real.
Absolutely. And in fact, during the pandemic, I had this idea of writing another solo show about Floyd Collins and about my time in Kentucky, but I wasn't really able to figure out how to make that be anything. But it forced mm-hmm. me to do a lot of research on Floyd Collins. So anyway, so Floyd mm-hmm. Collins, definitely.
Yeah. Oh, love that answer. That's not one that comes up a lot. So that's
I'm
really
sure.
Great.
Yeah.
Do you have a favorite filmed live musical? So not a movie musical, but a stage musical that's been filmed and put on screen.
So I saw Into the Woods. I loved that. And that was a
gateway drug.
Exactly. Get all those kids connected to, so I loved that, Into the Woods. Gosh, what else? Musical. I can't think of any right off the top of my head.
That's okay. Anything you watched over the pandemic, that theater in general, that springs to mind?
Well, I did. I watched a bunch of National Theater Live things. I really love those. Actually, I totally love those. Mm-hmm. It was really fun to see One Man, Two Governors again.
Yes.
So I love that. Gosh, what, you know what? The pandemic now is just like such ancient history for me. Right.
What is time? It's like, it all blurs together and
it all blurs together. So I saw a wonderful, do you know Jefferson Mays?
Mm-hmm.
He's always been an actor that totally fascinates me. Oh, well, there's another musical I loved, about the Abquinth family,
the Dicequiths.
Dicequiths, yes.
Gentleman's Guide to Murder.
Yes. That's another musical I love.
Yes.
And he, so he was in that. So he did a solo show at, during the pandemic. It was like Scrooge or something like that. Anyway, it was totally brilliant. And the other person is Bill Irwin. He did a solo show at the Irish Repertory Theater during the pandemic. That was just so beautiful. Yeah.
That Jefferson Mays Christmas Carol was so powerful and so amazing how he could transfer, like, I remember the staging of it was so beautiful. Like it surprised me how effective it was.
Yeah. And that was in the heart of the pandemic, right? In the middle of it. So everything was, it was amazing to me that they were able to get the lights and the stage and all of that stuff. So seamless. So yeah. Oh my gosh. I was just reminded of Michael Urie doing his Barbara Streisand play, Buyers and Sellers, I think it is. I don't know if you saw that. That was like right at the beginning of the pandemic. Yeah. So that's another one. Michael Urie. He's a very funny man.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
A filmed live musical. It's not exactly a stage show and it's not exactly a film. So what should we call it?
A filmed live musical. I don't know. A musical.
It's my favorite question. I know it tortures people, but it's something I'm obsessed with.
Filmed live musical. So wait, a musical that is only for film? It's filmed?
So think like Hamilton, like a musical that is on stage but has been filmed and then made available on screen.
I think it's a beautiful thing. That's what I think.
I love that. Where do you stand on bootlegs?
Bootlegs?
People watching illegal copies of stage shows or illegal copies of captures.
Yeah, I think that's really awful. I think it's really, really awful. Not only because the quality is bad, that's, you know, artistically, but I think that it deprives people of their livelihood, you know? It's really bad. Yeah. So, no, in fact, can I tell you something? This is time ago. Do you remember was it Napster?
Napster, yeah.
Yes, remember Napster? So I have an in-law. He's my husband's in-law, but a young guy. And he was talking about how great Napster was. Now, this guy, you know, was making like six figures when he was like 25, right? And he's talking to me about how great Napster is. It's so great to get all this free music and blah, blah, blah. And I said to him, how would you like it if you didn't get paid for what you do? How would you like it? He's like, what? And I said, well, that's what Napster is. That's what Napster is. And he's like, oh. I was like, yeah, think about that. It's so cool. No, it's not good.
That's a really fascinating thing to me. The Screen Actors Guild recently were, I think they're going to strike, or they wanted to strike because of streaming, that the way the contracts are set up, that, and this applies to film theater too, that the artists are not benefiting from the streams. Like, millions of people are streaming this content and the artists aren't getting paid. And one writer posted on Twitter that she had formerly been, like, her last residuals check was something like $100,000. And then over the past few years, her last check was like $12. And so how streaming, like, it opens up access, but it also... how do we compensate artists fairly for their work?
It's very complicated. Those people need to make, you know, I'm all for things being streamed by millions of people. Totally. You know, share the love. But I think that the people create need to be paid for that. Do you remember Friends, you know, the TV show Friends? Mm-hmm. Do you remember that the actors, I don't know that they struck, but they definitely were a united front because the producers and the networks were making so much money off of that show that they said that they asked for ridiculous salaries because they said, we deserve that because if you're going to make that money, we make that money too, because without us, you would have nothing. And I thought that was, you know, everyone was like, how dare they ask for so much money? I'm like, no.
Yeah.
They deserve that.
And that has like had a wash on effect, like the way Hamilton negotiated their contracts and from the very beginning, and then how they negotiated the contracts for the film too is it's so important.
It's very important.
What stage musicals do you wish had been filmed?
Well, Something Rotten for sure. Spamalot for sure. The thing that's awful is that even if it's streamed and even if it's filmed, it's still not the same experience. It's still not the same experience as going to the theater. And that's the hard part about it. So, although, you know, I have to say I loved the Into the Woods when they did that. That was just so, so wonderful. So in a sense, it's great. At least I get to see something that I wouldn't normally get to see.
And what you were saying earlier about, you know, people see it on the screen and then they want to buy tickets in person.
Yeah.
And that's like, there's data to support that when shows are released on screen, even a movie version, that ticket sales at the box office go up.
So yeah.
it's a win-win.
Yeah. I'm sure it's the same way in UK. In New York, you know, people come to New York and all they know about are five Broadway shows, right? That's all they know exists. And they're sort of in a befuddle about what should they see. And I don't blame them. They don't know, you know, tourists, everything like that.
And it's expensive. They only have so many shows they can see.
Exactly. And, you know, this idea of being able to see smaller things that are just as good, because even in New York, off Broadway is still practically Broadway anyway, right? But there's off Broadway and there's all sorts of amazing things that people don't know about. And, you know, it has to do with advertising budgets and publicity and all that stuff. It's very, very expensive. But I wish there was, you know, streaming things actually is a way for those things to get out in a way that so that they could even compete a little bit for audience. So yeah, I just wanted to add that.
That a perfect thing to add. I love that. What would you like to see filmed in the future?
Oh my goodness. What would I like to see filmed in the future? Well, I suppose like every Broadway show that's up right now would be fantastic. You know, that would be really good. I mean, you know, Strange Loop is going to close soon. That'd be really good to have Strange Loop.
What I would give. I really, you know, there's some big name producers behind that show, and I really, really hope that they invest in a pro shot.
Yeah. Or I don't know, maybe they'll bring it to UK. I mean, I don't know, but I would think they would film it because they should. So I think that should. So that would be one.
And final question, where can we find you online?
Oh, you can find me all sorts of places. I am on Instagram under Cynthia Sings and Velvet Determination. I'm on Twitter under Cynthia Sings, although I'm not terribly active on Twitter, but I am on there. I'm on TikTok under Cynthia Sings. But again, I go in and out of TikTok because that's a whole big thing. You can find me at my website, cynthiashaw.us. velvetdetermination.com. And then I also have a alter ego, Dr. Ivory Von Tickle, who is a online piano teacher. She teaches with Joy and Confusion. So she has 4 episodes. So you can look up Dr. Ivory Von Tickle. And then let's see, Instagram, Twitter. I'm on Facebook, Cynthia Shaw. And I think those are all the platforms, aren't they? Did I miss any?
Great. And yeah, that sounds right. And I'll have links to all of that in the show notes.
Okay, great.
Cynthia, this has been so much fun. Thank you so much for your time today.
Oh my gosh, this is fantastic.
The Filmed Live Musicals podcast is created and edited by our host, Louisa Lyons, with thanks to our wonderful patrons, Josh Brandon, Geraldine Brewer, Belinda Broido, Elliot Charles, Rachel Esteban, Mercedes Esteban Lyons, Luke Hasselman, David Jones, James T. Lane, Heather Madrone, Wendy Marcotte, Alison Matthews, Al Monaco, David McGrin, Amy Penn, Gerald Piper, Jesse Rabinowitz and Brenda Goodman, David and Catherine Rabinowitz, Joe Tillotson, Beck Twist, and Tyson Van Helsing for financially supporting the site. FilmedLiveMusicals.com is the most comprehensive list of film stage musicals. You can follow us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. If you would like early access to this very podcast, early access to site content, the full weekly newsletter with info on upcoming streams, and exclusive access to the streaming calendar, become a Filmed Live Musicals patron for as little as $3 a month. Visit filmedlivemusicals.com to learn more. If you like what you hear, please leave a review on Apple Music. It really helps get the word out about the show. I hope you enjoyed this episode, and thanks for listening.